see in an experimental talk, but just enough to sort of understand what's going on and the limitations. And then talk about reconstructing W's and Z's and TOPS to get a feeling for their kinematics because they're the backgrounds for BSM searches in many cases. And go through the sort of CMS analog of the Atlas paper that Philip went through the other day. I know it's a very similar analysis, but the reason I want to go through it is that they talk in great detail about measuring the backgrounds in data. And so that's the part I want to spend some time on. So this is a sort of cartoon snapshot of CMS. It has a silicon tracker, which is made up of a bunch of pixels on the inside and then a bunch of strips further out. Electromagnetic calorimeter, hadron calorimeter, and then a muon detector. So if you have the tracker, first let me just talk about what each one measures. Tracker is basically detecting and measuring p, the momentum, really 1 over p, of charged particles. So it measures 1 over p by the deflection. One thing that's important to realize is that it really needs a lot of pattern recognition. It's a busy environment, and you need software to reconstruct where a track went from the hits and individual layers, so that's something that can sometimes go wrong. But in general, it can reconstruct these tracks correctly a large fraction of the time and use them to measure the momentum of charged particles. So charged particles leave a little bit of energy in the silicon strips when they pass through. Neutral particles don't. That's why it only sees the charged guys. Then there are these two calorimeters. Calorimeters are literally measuring the energy of the particles that go through them. But they're measuring the energy of particles that have a high interaction rate in the material, so that, for example, an electron going through a radiation-thick layer, like the E-cal, what will happen, and I know Michael talked about this, the electron will bremsstrahlung, and then you're left with a photon that carries order half the energy and an electron that carries order half the energy. That electron will go a little further, and then it'll bremsstrahlung again. The photon will go a little further, and then it'll convert to an E plus E minus pair. So each one of these steps is an interaction with the nucleus. And throughout, there are layers of some energy absorber that are measuring the energy of these guys. So this is what's called a shower. These are actual pictures of a simulated event shower. And by measuring the total energy in that shower, you get an estimate of the total energy in the event. So the E-cal, the electromagnetic calorimeter, is measuring total energy of electrons and photons. These are the two things that shower efficiently in the E-cal. In the H-cal, you're measuring the total energy of hadrons. So protons, neutrons, pi plus or minuses, etc. Things like a pi zero will decay to two photons far inside this point in the detector. And I say total energy. That should really be in quotes, because some of the time you'll have a hadron that actually goes through here. It showers a bit, but the energy doesn't get completely absorbed in the calorimeter. So the hadron will go through, it'll shower, you get another pion, etc. But some of these guys have enough energy to make it out of the E-cal, and that's lost energy. So this is asymmetric, it's non-Gaussian, and it'll come back to be something that one cares about a lot when thinking about missing energy searches, because lost energy of jets can be a source, not surprisingly, of missing energy. All right, the muons don't have hadronic interactions. They brem a lot less. The cross sections for these processes for an electron, sigma brem, so sigma E nucleus goes to E gamma, or gamma nucleus goes to E plus E minus nucleus. these parametrically go like alpha squared times z squared over m electron squared. For a muon, the Brehm process goes like alpha squared z squared over m muon squared. So they deposit very much less energy. They don't shower in the ECAL. Instead, the way they're measured is precisely by the fact that they can just blaze through all this material and go into this other set of tracking layers further out, which then measure their momentum. So the muon chambers measure, again, 1 over p for muons. And then the other thing, so of course the presence or absence, I've just told you different detectors actually are sensitive to different particles. So by which signals actually occur and which ones don't, one can deduce what kind of particle actually passed through. But there are fakes. So for example, sometimes you'll have a fake electron from a jet that contains a pi zero and a pi plus or minus. The pi zero converts to two photons, and the photons deposit energy in the ECAL. So you get a big ECAL signal from that. And then you have a pi plus that gives you a track and not much energy, for whatever reason, not much energy in the HCAL. So that's just one example of a process that would fake an electron. And because there are fakes, the experiments always have selection criteria for a good electron that try to reduce this, but also fail to identify some fraction of the real electrons. And then the other type of thing that the tracker does is it can detect displaced vertices, which are a signal of B quarks much of the time. So B mesons have a lifetime C tau of about half a millimeter. And if you look at a jet that had a B quark, say from top decay or from BB bar production, then it'll shower, do its thing. You get, a jet. But at the end of the day, that'll hadronize into, for example, a B meson. So you get a jet that contains a bunch of pions, some kaons, what have you, mostly pions. But it'll contain also this B meson. The B meson lives a while before decaying. And what you see in that jet is that some of the tracks actually point back to a vertex that's separated from the main vertex of the event. So I'll show you some real pictures of that that are better than this slide. Okay. This is basically how particles are identified. The reason I'm telling you is that it's important to sort of understand the pathologies, the things that can go wrong in identification, in order to understand what's some of the backgrounds for searches. All right, so one thing, I'll come back to particle flow later if we talk about the CMS search. But here are just a few examples of real events, event displays for real events detected last year. So these first few are from CMS. What you see in this event is a track. So now let me tell you the color code for this, and the ATLAS will use a slightly different color code. All of these things on the inside are obviously tracks. The red and blue are, red is the electromagnetic calorimeter energy. Blue is the hadronic calorimeter energy. And then you can see here reconstruction going through the muon chambers. So this guy that went through the muon chambers is a good muon candidate. And there isn't that much other energy or high PT tracks in the event. So they can infer a missing energy going that way. So what this event has in it, as far as really energetic objects, is it has a muon going one way and missing energy plus it going the other way. So what kind of particle might this be? You can see the actual PT of the muon up here, 38.7 GeV. The missing energy was reconstructed to be 37.9. MT was 75. So what kind of particle might that be? Oh, the missing energy itself, yeah. But the whole event. Where might that? What kind of scattering process could have produced that neutrino in the muon? All right. So which particles couple to neutrinos? First of all, what's the total charge? Okay, I don't know whether it's a mu plus or a mu minus. Let's say it's a mu plus. So the total charge of the event is the high energy stuff is what? Right, just one. And what kinds of particles couple to neutrinos?
Pions.
Well, pions decay to neutrinos, yeah. Okay, but so it's true, pions do decay to muon neutrino some of the time, right? If a pion decays to the muon and the neutrino, what should the invariant mass of that muon and the neutrino be? It should be m pi, right? Which is about 100 MeV. And this mt that you construct has to be less than the mass of the pion, and it was 80 GeV, basically. So it's not a pion. A pion could have produced a muon missing energy right next to each other. But actually, most pions live too long and would go through the detector before they decay. So that's the other way. You know, it's probably not a pion. So what else in the standard model couples to neutrinos? Right. Yeah. Right. So this is actually, well, there's a good chance that this event is the direct production of a W boson. So unlike all the stuff that we talked about in week one, which was at low energies, at 7 TeV, you have more than enough energy to produce W bosons. And the transverse mass here is close to the W mass. So this is a pretty good candidate for a W decaying to a muon and a neutrino. And if you measure the direction of the curvature of that muon, which we could if we knew what direction the field went in this diagram, then you'd know whether it was a W plus or a W minus.
So how is that W created? It says we created somewhere and then directed into this?
Right. So remember we were talking about the way to think about it is just that you have a quark and an anti-quark from the initial state partons. That just resonantly produces a W if their invariant mass is MW. And then that decays to a muon and a neutrino. So that's one diagram. The other diagrams you can think about are things where you also radiate off an extra gluon, for example. So this would have produced a W that had some net PT, right? Because the gluon would have some net transverse momentum, the W should balance it. So more likely, this was just that process. Right, so they have other ones.
Is it isolated from this? Is this only some of the events, or is this?
Well, this is just one event that they picked out because it looks like a W. Yeah, so most of the events look just like, well, most of the events just have a sputtering of soft tracks and actually nothing high energy. This is a point that I meant to make earlier. Now's actually a good time to make it, though. So they have a collision every 100 nanoseconds. So that's 10 to the 7 or so. Right now they're trying to run with 50 nanoseconds timing. So that's order 10 to the 7 events per second. And they can't write that much data out. They can write out 100 events per second. So there's a trigger process designed to pick out interesting events. Things like an event with an electron, with a muon that has reasonably high momentum and isn't close to a lot of other tracks. An isolated muon, that's one kind of trigger they have. Or things with like five jets reconstructed, they have triggers for that. And how high energy the jets have to be, that's something they change dynamically as they vary the luminosity.
Five jets, like for looked at every event and reconstructed.
Right. Okay. So what?
Does it have jets?
Right. So what they do, indeed. Both experiments have multi-level triggering. The first level, and I only have the numbers down for CMS right now. Their level one is always hardware. And this takes their 10 to the 7 hertz that they start with down to about 10 to the 5 hertz. So this is all little like hardware analysis, really hardwired to be extremely fast, I think in many cases, in or right next to the detector, that just processes these events and sends a signal bit that this is an interesting event when at some very preliminary reconstruction level, They have these signals. So for example, you can use whether these electronics in the muon chamber are firing at all, right? Or some kind of total energy deposited in the calorimeter. Those are things that can be fed together at hardware level. But don't involve a lot of detailed reconstruction. And then they have higher level triggers that in general reduce it down to about 100 hertz. They're thinking they may be able to go up to a few hundred hertz, but still, that's an extra factor of 1,000. So in CMS, this is done in just one stage. What they do is they farm these guys to 1,000 computers. And so each computer gets 100 hertz and has about 30 to 100 milliseconds to decide, is this an interesting enough event to keep? So they have some very fast particle reconstruction algorithms that they run in those 30 milliseconds on each event. Decide, okay, this is a good event, this isn't. Keep this one, throw away that one. The algorithms for these triggers are designed so that they'll have a high efficiency for the kinds of events that you actually want to study. So for example, there are triggers designed to capture events that look like Ws based on having a high energy muon that's relatively isolated, and some apparent missing ET constructed in a very simple-minded manner. Not simple-minded compared to things we could dream up in this class, not very complex compared to that, very simple-minded compared to their eventual reconstructions. So like they don't apply all the corrections to them at the trigger level that they do in the final analysis. But yeah, getting these triggers right is a big deal, because that's what determines which events they get to. Like, let's say they take an inverse femtobarn of data with the wrong triggers. They can't analyze those events. They lose all their interesting events. They can't do anything at all. You just threw those away. So this is really crucial. Okay, so here's another event. It has, again, a lot of soft tracks going through the detector. One track that's associated with a lot of energy deposited in the electromagnetic calorimeter. So if it deposits a lot of energy in the electromagnetic calorimeter, something's probably either an electron, a pion that decayed to two gammas, or just a gamma. If there's a track associated with it too, then it's a good candidate for an electron. So that's an electron, 35.6 GeV transverse momentum. And then again, there's not much other stuff going on in the event, so it's nearly balanced by missing energy, 36.9 GeV. And so this is another W candidate, this one a W going to E minus, or E plus, I still don't know which, and a neutrino. Now Ws also decay to hadrons. They also decay to, you also get diget W events. But we can't show you any candidates for that, because even though the W even if you plotted the diget invariant mass, there'd be a little peak for the W, but it would be on top of a way huger background from QCD. Okay, so one can't actually reconstruct the W in digets because the QCD is so high, QCD background. The Z you can reconstruct in BB bar, kind of, but it's hard. There's still a lot of background. Okay, so those are two W's. Here's an event. There were two tracks that went out into the muon layers, right? So these are both muons. And now here you can see there were also some sort of jet-like things in the event, right? This is there's a bunch of tracks, a lot of energy deposition in both calorimeters, likewise here. So this looks like, and then, so you have two muons. One can just fully reconstruct the invariant mass of the pair, and it's 93.2 GeV, which is within errors the mass of the Z. So this is probably, this is at least a candidate for a Z to mu plus mu minus event. But if you look at the PTs, the whole Z was actually boosted. So this is probably the other kind of diagram that I started drawing, where you actually have a quark and a gluon. So this is the going to a Z plus a jet. And there's a couple of diagrams that one can draw for Z plus jet. So you can draw this with either a Q or a Q bar initial state. You can draw this, where you have a QQ bar initial state, and instead of radiating off a quark that turns into a jet, you radiate off a gluon. But if you remember all the parton luminosity pictures, the gluon has a much higher parton luminosity than the antiquark. So this is usually the dominant Z plus jet process. Yes, there is, precisely because, well, so it goes in fairly straight lines, but they do have very good precision. So, for example, in the inner layers of the tracker, so that goes out about 1 meter, and as you'd expect, it gets harder at high momenta. The higher the momentum of the muon, high momentum muons are really hard to measure the charge of, just because you're trying to measure a very small deflection. But at reasonably low momenta, so you have roughly 1 meter of tracker, and you're actually sensitive to deflections on the order of 100 microns. So that's 10 to the minus 4. Now, of course, that's the sort of delta phi of the track, right, relative to a straight track. You can measure that it got deflected by that. From that and the fact that the magnetic field is about 4 tesla, you can estimate what's the highest charge that they can roughly discriminate. What's the highest momentum at which they can discriminate the charge? But I'm not going to try to do that in real time because the conversions are not things I'm especially good at.
So they do that
for the muons, sorry. For electrons, they have to use the silicon tracker. For muons, they can also use the muon chambers. And I actually don't know how the sensitivity compares because the muon chambers are much lower resolution. They actually can't, in many cases, use a time of flight to determine exactly where the muon hit, and they don't have the kind of granularity that the silicon has. Actually, I was reminded this morning that they have 200 square meters of silicon packed into the inner 1 meter radius cylinder of the detector. I mean, It's really a huge amount of material, and these are all either 100 micron by 100 micron pixels of silicon with individual readouts, or there are things that are ordered 10 centimeter strips that are 10 centimeters long, but 100 microns in diameter, in thickness. So I don't remember whether the angular discrimination is actually higher or lower in the muon chambers, because they have lower resolution, but they're further away. This is another zeta dimuons. Same kind of deal, except now instead of just, they're also, one of the muons went into the end cap of the detector rather than the central regions. So here, this is, if you imagine doing a rotation about the beam axis to get the full shape of the detector. These form a cylinder, while the blue ones form two disks. Right, so these disk parts are called the edge caps, and one of the muons went into the end cap detector. They can still reconstruct that as a Z, but the end cap detectors end up having somewhat worse resolution. And then this is another Z going to, now there's an electron, so again these are mostly electromagnetic deposits with accompanying tracks. This is a clearly reconstructed electron, only one track going this direction, and it deposits a lot of energy in the electromagnetic calorimeter. This looks to me like a somewhat less well-reconstructed electron, because there's actually a lot of tracks that are going in the same direction. But it's still an electron candidate, and given that the two reconstruct the Z mass, there's a pretty good chance that was a real Z event. But this is the kind of confounding thing that you can have. If there's two tracks going really close to each other that point in the direction of your E-cal deposit, maybe one of them was a pi plus, one of them was an E minus. You're using the track to determine the sign, so some of the time it's hard to know whether you've got an E minus or an E plus, because you don't, unless you know which track to associate with it.
They look fun because they're really bendy, but actually they never even make it out to the electromagnetic calorimeter because they run at the circle. So
yeah. So I think the momentum that it takes to get out is maybe like 3 GeV, but I'm not sure of that. And yeah, the bendy tracks are the stuff that you want to ignore in general. Now, sometimes you can have a lot of fairly bendy tracks that are all part of a jet. You want to reconstruct the total energy of that jet. So actually, it is very useful to try to pay attention to those bendy tracks. And that's what the particle flow algorithms try to do. Not for like 1 GeV things that never make it out, but for higher energy things that do. Again, I'm not sure if I'll actually talk about particle flow or not. Okay, so here's one more event. So this picture doesn't show it. Did I include the other picture? No. So this one is from ATLAS, the other detector, the other experiment. So they have a muon here. Boy, this shows up really badly on the projector. Green is the H-cal. Yellow is the E-cal deposition. So here they are, or do I have it reversed? Maybe green is the E-cal. Somewhere there's a track over here that you really can't see on this black background, which is actually, yeah, which is pointing to a big deposition in the green, which is actually the E-cal. I got it backwards before. So this is an electron candidate. This guy, obviously, because he's hitting the muon chambers, is a muon candidate. There's a couple of areas with a lot of energy deposited in the H-cal, which are reconstructed as jets. So you can see this You can't see anything on this plot, I'm sorry. All right. Hopefully you can kind of see on here. There's this additional plot over here that's just called a Lego plot, where they just show the density. but it's tiny. up a bit? Sure. So then this over here is what I really wanted to show you up close, is a close-up of where the tracks come from in their when they reconstruct tracks from the silicon. So there's those three tracks that are colored blue that actually seem to be coming from a different point. And that looks like, so that looks like a B meson candidate. And based on that, they tagged the jet associated with it, which I don't know what jet it is, even based on the big picture. They tag one of the jets as a B jet candidate. So this event has a B candidate going one way, some other jets, an electron. I'm not trying to draw the directions correctly. An electron and a muon. So without looking at the top of that slide, what kind of event might that be? Okay, it's a top. It's a top candidate. Now, okay, things to note, B jets, tops, so tops always decay. Say you produce a TT bar. Tops, in the standard model, they always decay to BW. So this would be a B bar. W, sorry. In the standard model, okay. Fine. It's actually not quite. It's yeah. I'll talk about the other decay modes in a minute. So the only measured decay mode for the top is this, where the top goes to a B W plus, the T bar goes to a B W minus. And then, I mean, you can break down how the W's are going to decay, right? So W decays basically 20% of the time to E or mu. E or mu 20% of the time, tau 10% of the time, hadrons 70% of the time. Treating the tau separately because the taus are really hard to reconstruct, whereas electrons and muons are simple enough to reconstruct with high efficiency that they can actually color them on those plots. So if you have two W's, then of course usually when people talk about leptons, they're actually talking about E or mu. Tau is not a lepton in experimental particle physics parlance, because most of the time it decays to a couple of pions, and it's just hard to see, hard to reconstruct. So that means that tops can decay to L plus L minus 0.2 times 0.2, with probability 0.2 times 0.2, right? So that's 4% of the time. You get an L plus L minus. They can go to L plus, and here I mean E or mu plus a neutrino. So this is plus nu nu. L mu either sign plus a jets. Sorry, I should use more space for this. Because top is something that one really worries about as a background for a lot of different searches. So okay. So the W goes to L mu, where L equals E or mu, 20% of the time, to tau nu 10% of the time, and to jet roughly 70% of the time. That means that TT bar goes to L nu, L minus nu, BB bar, right, when both of these W's are leptonic, 0.2 times 0.2, or 4% of the time. It goes to L plus nu, jet, BB bar, or L minus nu, I'll do it the other way, jet, L minus nu, so this is the W plus decay, this is the W minus decay. Either one of these is 0.7 times 0.2. So that's 0.14 for each. All told, then 28% of the time, they go to a lepton, one lepton plus jets. And then they go to jet, BB bar, the other 0.7 times 0.7 of the time. So that's 50%. And the remaining roughly 20% of the events involve at least one tau. So then involving tau, the rest involve a tau. And I just want to tell you, so why is TOP a problem for jets plus missing energy searches like the one that you guys looked at with Philip at the last class? Well, these things involving a tau, they also involve a tau neutrino, which contributes to the missing energy. But when that tau decays hadronically, then you can't tell that there was a lepton there. So, I mean, these searches veto leptons, because sources of leptons usually also involve neutrinos, or can also involve neutrinos. That's a source of missing energy. Top decays that involve a tau, you can't tag that there was a lepton, but there's still a neutrino there. So these are an important background to beyond the standard model searches with missing energy, that one just has to measure from these events with visible leptons. All right, so, sorry, I was going to talk about exotic decay modes at the top, so I don't remember all the numbers very well, but basically there have been, so in the standard model you have this, and you do also have CKM suppressed decays to, say, the strange quark and a W. So this is suppressed by VTS squared, which I think is like 10 to the minus 4. I'm not sure of that number. So this has never been measured. We have nowhere near that amount of precision in the decays. And part of the reason we don't is that these tagging methods for B quarks actually only work about half the time. So half the time a B quark will be produced, it'll decay, but either the vertex isn't clean enough, or the B quark actually decayed too early for them to cleanly resolve that it really was a late decay.
Does that come from simulating it, knowing that the event that you simulated actually did have a B quark in it and you didn't notice?
To measure it reliably, one needs to measure it in the data itself. By using cross correlations, for example, and there's a method called tag and probe, which I'll talk about for leptons later. I may talk about it. Not sure how far we'll get. So there's a method called tag and probe for measuring these things in the data, and then they also look at detailed Monte Carlo simulations to try to cross check it. But this is one of those things where if you want to get it, measure that fraction fairly precisely, you really have to do it in the data, because the simulations just are not at all guaranteed to get it right. So in order to measure this decay, which is basically the same signal except that it's never tagged, you'd have to actually know the B tagging fraction to within 10 to the minus 4 precision. And that's just orders of magnitude worse than one actually knows it. These things usually have several percent. That probability of tagging a B quark when you really have one is known to within a few percent. And it depends on the algorithm. But for most of the algorithms that are commonly used, it's about 50%. At least that's a good ballpark number to keep in mind. So this is basically unmeasurable. Like, even in principle, it's unmeasurable, but expected in the standard model. There have been searches for things like Z plus charm. So this would be a flavor-changing neutral current. So in the standard model, you expect 0, but it's been searched for, and there are limits on the rate that I think the limits from the Tevatron are about 10%, but I am not sure of that number. It's from memory. Also, there have been searches for charged Higgses produced in the decay. So this would be if there was a complicated Higgs sector with some charged Higgses. Supersymmetry has charged Higgses as well. If the charged Higgs is lighter than the top, then one could go to charged Higgs B. And the way you'd tell the difference is that the charged Higgs would have different branching fractions from a W. So in some cases, it goes to a charm, an anti-strange quark, or it could go to a tau plus and a neutrino. And so one can look for anomalous branching fractions to these modes. And the limits are, I think, about 10% for a charged Higgs that goes to charm strange, 20%. I know you can't see this, but you don't really need to remember it anyway. 20% for the tau nu. So the top system, in terms of rare decays, the top system isn't actually measured that well. But everything that's been measured so far is consistent with the standard model picture that this is the only decay mode, or the only measurable decay mode. Again, this strange quark one is so rare that one can basically forget about it. All right, so we have 1 hour left, and probably two, realistically, 1 hour things that I was planning to do. So we should pick one. So I put up on the website some Mathematica packages to look at kinematic distributions for these standard model processes, WZ and top production. So we can either look through those, or we can look through one of the search papers and talk about how the backgrounds are actually, how each of these processes contributes to the background to Suzy searches, and how the backgrounds are measured in the experiments. I think going through the kinematics first might be somewhat clearer. But if you guys want to just go ahead to the searches, we can do that instead. Mathematica, okay. All right, so if you guys just go to the wiki page for this class, there should be this little link to files for kinematics and analysis tutorial. So have you guys downloaded that already, or shall I wait for everyone to download it? Yeah. So it doesn't have any label on it. Let me, I can fix that quickly. But while you guys are downloading. Ooh. Do you guys have, I guess, sorry, these are all Linux, right? Okay. So tar is definitely on there. Okay. Have you guys untarred the files, or does it? Oh, sorry. So first thing, under April 15th, there's this files link, number 3. Very, very informative, I know. Sorry. I linked this like 5 minutes before class started, so. Okay, and then do you guys know where these files actually get downloaded to on your machines? Okay, so can you go into that directory and tar xvzf, that thing? Oh, really? Great. Okay.
It was nice.
All right. Okay, so if everybody's extracted, well, people who have extracted, here, let me look at your thing so I can see what it actually looks like. Okay. Yeah, so you can go ahead and click on Chameleon SM Tutorial Psi, because the other one probably has some outdated functionality. All right, so has everybody opened it up in Mathematica? Looks like it. All right, so the first thing we need to do is go to the basic setup. So set directory to, if you don't actually know what directory the files are in, that's okay. You don't actually need to run that. Yeah, you do, I think. So just change this to whatever directory the files are in. And then run this chameleon psi.m command below it. So I thought so, but it's not appearing for me. So if it doesn't appear for you, don't worry about it. Is anything appearing for you?
No.
What happens if you enter some garbage file name? Like just add a 2 into the name somewhere. And I think it'll say file not found. Yeah, okay. So if it doesn't display any red text below it, it should be fine. So yeah, just get rid of the 2 now. Okay. Did everybody manage to load it? All right. So then you can run this guy with a WZT prolim. And it's probably going to just, unless you happen to be in the right directory, it'll pop up a file browser. But you can just browse over to where the file is, or you can actually just delete everything before the WZT.lso command. Like everything up to the examples and then the slash. If you just delete that, I think it'll just load properly for you.
Should it take forever?
It should take a little while, yeah, because it's loading, I think, 50,000 events. Do you want to like download the software that everyone else is playing with?
I can't get it working.
Oh, you can't? Well, sorry, not the PGS stuff. We're actually not using PGS today. We're just going to use things that I simulated before.
Okay.
Yeah. All right, so I'll just tell you, by the way, if you guys go to... If you guys look at the WZT.log, what it'll tell you is the cross sections for all the different processes that it simulated. Sorry, that's in the same directory. There's something called WZT.log. So that tells you a little bit about the file that I generated. It tells you that we had 50,000 events. So It's a long file, so it starts with some parameters about how it's simulating the detector. And I mean, PGS is sort of a catch-all first-order approximation of what a detector does. So it reconstructs jets, it applies some parametrized smearing function to them, it has just like a probability that it chooses whether to assign a B tag to a real B jet or not. A probability for identifying an electron as an electron, and so on. So there's just a lot of probabilities coded into it to sort of mimic the kinds of inefficiencies that a detector has. Then you can see parameters, a bunch of this Pythia screen, and it says a bunch of parameters with cryptic names changed from 0 to 1. That just means that it's reading from a cart, from a what's called a card file, which is also included in this directory. The values of these parameters, and each of these parameters is telling it to turn on a particular process. So I think these two are W plus jets, these two are top plus jets, and these are W plus jet, these are Z plus jet, and these guys are top. But that's just my guess. It's all commented a little more thoroughly in the file. Then it says, okay, a lot of other junk. It gives outputs a decay table. So the way to read this is, for example, if you want to see how often, how often the top decays different ways, you scroll down to the line 6, and it'll tell you that the top, and there's three lines that are non-zero, right? So WB, 99.8% of the time, and then 0.2% of the time to WS, and 3⁻⁵ to WD. So all of those are implemented. Yeah. But it's implemented. That should not lead you to believe that that level of accuracy is actually attained by the simulation. Everywhere, there's things that it gets wrong by order one amounts. but all of those decay modes are included. And then you can also go to like 23 and see how the Z decays. And 24, how the W decays, and so on. I'm not going to go through that in any kind of detail. So if you scroll to the very bottom of this file, so first it goes through that decay table, then it displays in gory detail exactly what happened in like the first 10 events that it simulated. So like, you know, I produced a top, it decayed, or I produced a W, it decayed. It produced two quarks, and then they showered a lot, and it produced this many quarks going in this direction, this many photons going in that direction, and eventually they hadronized into a bunch of kaons and omegas and rhos and pis. So all of that is stored in here for 10 events, but you don't really want to read it. PGS processes it into something much more palatable. And then it tells you the cross sections for each of the different, in millibarns, for each of the different processes that it generated. So the highest cross sections that it's talking about, that it has, are about 5⁻⁴ millibarns. That's the total, 5⁻⁴ millibarns. About half of that is for gluon plus W. Most of it is for either gluon plus W or quark plus W. Some of it's gluon plus Z, but you see that's down by a factor of about 2. And then some of it, these capital Q bar, that means top. But
what does it mean by tried?
What that means is basically that it goes, I mean, it's a Monte Carlo algorithm. Mm-hmm. So sometimes, so it's gonna sample the phase space, and then at a given point in phase space, it'll throw a random number to decide, it'll like calculate the matrix element, throw a random number, and if that random number is less than the probability associated with that matrix element, it'll keep the event, otherwise it throws it out. So this is, I mean, so that's some internal thing about the Monte Carlo that one can use for diagnosing how efficient it's being, but not especially, not something we're ever going to use. And then these number generated, that's just telling you basically the breakdown of the actual event sample that you're looking at. How many gluon plus Z events are there? How many top events? So you see this whole, all of these top events that we, even though we included top, it's only 40 events out of the 50,000 that we simulated. And also, this is about 0.1 picobarns of data. So already, the LHC had, from last year, 350 times more data than is in this file to analyze.
How long did it take to generate those?
For me, I honestly don't remember.
Okay.
I mean, I this is a file I generated 3 years ago.
How long did you expect it to take?
Usually takes, I mean, I'd say every 1,000 events. I think it's like 100 events a second, a few hundred events a second, something of that order. Depends exactly on, I mean, the processors have gotten faster, but that's my rough recollection. So, you know, this is something that'll keep your computer churning for a while if you generate it, but not prohibitively long. You could absolutely generate this sample yourself. Okay, so back to Mathematica. You loaded the events. Now, actually, you can look at summaries of what's in the event below. So this is just the length of the data set. I mean, the purpose of this file is largely to give you example syntax and to show the distributions. You actually don't need to rerun every command, although there's a few commands that I'll ask you to rerun to make sure that they still work in your version of Mathematica.
Which file are we loading out of the example?
Good. So it's the one we were just looking at, the WZT.
Huh?
WZT.LHCO?
LHCO.
Yeah. Oh, I see. Sorry, that was the question. Yeah.
Yeah, I just wanted to know the
slides. Right. So the LHCO files, I mean, one can open them in a text editor too. And I'll just show you. You don't need to, but. What they contain is these zeros mark the beginning of an event, and then it says, okay, there were six hard enough objects for me to care about in the event. Let's see if I can remember. Sorry. So 4 means a jet. I think I define this later on in the Mathematica file, and I actually don't remember. But these are stored in, these are stored internally as there's like a type ID where 4 is a jet, 6 is missing energy, I think 1 and 2 are electrons, 3 are taus, which you should not trust this software for at all, and 5 is a B tagged jet.
Second event is just missing
energy? 5 is not a B tagged
jet.
Yeah, so that's just missing energy, but if you look at the actual PT of that missing energy, it's 13 GeV, so it's pretty low. What that's doing, this was probably a zeta neutrinos event, where the Z was produced with a low PT jet, and there's some threshold on the lowest PT of jet that it'll print here. Although it seems to be pretty low. But then it'll just sum, so there were no jets above that threshold, but it just sums the PTs of all the tracks in the event and gets a PT out. So you should take those numbers as sums, like this event and that event, as some indication of the resolution in PT, that it'll reconstruct PTs of order 10 gem just out of nothing. And that's not, differences of that size in missing energy are not physically meaningful. And that's roughly the right order of magnitude also for real detectors. And then, so the next four columns are the kinematics of the jets, so eta phi PT, and it reconstructs an invariant mass for the jet, the number of tracks in the event, and in this column, whether it's V-tagged or not. There aren't many tops in this event. But I think I just spotted one. When you do have a top event, it'll look like there's a good chance that one of the Bs will be tagged, and it'll be either 1.0 or 2.0 in that column. Obviously, reading these event files isn't very illustrative of anything, so that's why we're using the Mathematica notebook to analyze it. So we're loading these WZs and tops. Then you can skip this example equals case. That's just something you can use to bring up the file browser if you ever want to load events that way. Then there's this apply muon isolation command, which you should run. And what that does is that the software just keeps track of, well, first actually type this length command just to make sure that you actually loaded the file properly. Like, I clearly haven't. It should give you 50,000 when you run length of WZT per lim. So, does it for everyone? You get one? Then you also must be loading the wrong file. So yeah, I think for you guys, get 50,000. I think if you just run it this way, it should probably, for you, not for me, because I'm not in the right directory. It should probably load it properly. So is everybody getting 50,000 now?
My computer's frozen.
Oh, really?
But I have stuff, so much stuff open, I don't want to shut it off.
Okay, but you can look over someone's shoulder. All right. Do you guys both get 50,000? Oh, okay. Let's see. You guys, what directory did you have to switch to in order to run Chameleon PSI? Everyone should at least get that set up.
Yeah.
So.
Root.
Oh, like
know.
In
just,
your
I
first
just,
your first set directory.
The directory that the file's in.
Yeah,
okay.
When I downloaded the file, I just put it in my home directory.
All right. So do you know what directory you downloaded it to?
Yeah, that's, I mean, I did
put
that.
Just
straight
away, you
can't.
Yeah.
My city going,
we
can't
do that.
Okay, so where can you go up to the file browser?
What file browser?
Actually, sorry, if it doesn't do anything, that probably means it worked.
This one's a piece. I can even do update.
Try running that, but delete examples too. You can just, well, it looks like, okay, you can just change the username, or you can delete everything and just leave examples. Leave it. Like this also works. I don't want to.
When you select, did you do this one and select it from the,
no,
I
bumped
it.
Should I try that?
Try that, yeah.
Okay, it's running.
Great. Okay,
it's
and then, Okay, now can you run this length command that I have underneath it? You'll have to add that, because that wasn't in the version that I sent you guys. You don't need to do the example line. We're not using this, that one.
Oh, no, that's how Mac got it to work.
Okay.
Well, I was just saying it was redundant, but it's not working, so I figured.
If you want to do it using the example line, you should change example to WZT prelim, because all the, or you can just below say WZT prelim.
So how did yours work?
So yeah, actually, for those of you that want to just load it directly, I think if you just get rid of all the prefix stuff and all the directories and just say wzt.lhco, it'll work. All right, is it 50,000? Awesome. Okay, so we all have events. Now you guys should run this apply muon isolation command, which should be pretty quick. And then these three commands under check the data set, which, that looks bad.
It just says tet 1.
Yeah, that is bad.
It's still wrong.
The check the data set?
Well, it says 1.
Yeah, you guys should do command period, or whatever it is. That's that. Alt period? Yeah, you guys should cancel that command. It's doing something fishy.
Apply muon isolation.
Yeah, it's not. Apply muon isolation does not seem to be working.
Why is it something using a very large
output? Yeah, so just tell it to show nothing. And I'm sorry, I seem to have broken apply muon isolation. So.
I mean, how do you abort this
cell? Alt period? Vigorously and repeatedly?
Once worked. to cancel, to abort the.
Huh? Oh, okay. For me, sometimes it has to be multiple times.
That's what went wrong with mine last time. So it had loaded the data, but then I applied muon isolation, then asked for the length of it, and it gave me 1.
Uh huh.
So it's mangled at the moment.
So, okay, we might just have to. Well, I don't even have. On muon isolation, but fine. Did I not run? Sorry, either this will have a quick fix or it won't, and then we'll have to go to the backup plan of either running on the prelim data set or not running anything at all and just talking about the histograms that I generated. But I don't understand. It worked for me earlier. Sorry, let me just... Yeah. And for prelim, it's not doing anything sensible? Hmm. Yeah, it seems like there's something. I broke something. I think it's just not saving all of the commands. So if I can in the next 5 minutes actually get a new version up on the website that works, then... Well, actually, there's another thing you can do. Should work, which is to just open up this .nb notebook, and then just basically, when you do that, you can click on this outer bar to collapse it all into one cell. Select the outer bar and run it, and that'll run all the commands in the notebook, not just the ones that are. It might. So let me before you guys do that, let me make sure that it actually works. Okay, it's taking time.
Chameleon PSI.
Oh, yeah, it went. ChameleonPSI.nb. And then you collapse everything into one cell. Run the outer bar on that cell. So I'll go back to it. Yeah, I mean, I think you can also do evaluate notebook from the menu. And that works. But if it doesn't take a long time, you're doing the wrong thing. But I mean, it should only take a few seconds. So yeah, so if you select the outer bar and then do shift enter.
Yeah, I think it worked.
Okay. Yeah, it looks like it. All right. So Beth, you got that too? All right, great. So now we can go back to the other notebook and actually continue. sorry about that.
Should we try the apply muon
isolation? Yeah, so run the apply muon isolation again, and it should take a couple of seconds. Okay, and now you can do this length and stuff again, and it'll...
Okay, I did something. I did a matrix.
Great.
What's the difference?
All right.
Mine worked.
Did you select the outer bar in the other notebook?
Yeah.
Do you want to do it again? Just, yeah. Well. You'll have to do that again, because there's two commands that take forever. How did he bring that up?
I don't know why I did that.
Alt comma, I think, might actually give you more control. You can try that, too. Yeah, and then abort command being evaluated. Okay. Okay, great. So now go back to the other chameleon PSI. And if you just select the outer guy, run it. Okay, do you want to try applying muon isolation again?
That's instantaneous.
That's a bad sign.
Maybe if I just run it.
Mm-hmm. Here. Can I type? Do you mind if I type with slightly chalky hands?
No, go ahead.
Fine. All right. Well, maybe you should look over somebody else's shoulder and we can diagnose this offline. All right. So these events are just showing you that it worked and it can read events, but again, not very instructive. These are the codes for what kind of particle each line is. So photon, electron, muon, tau, jet, or missing energy. And now we're going to define some subsamples. Callum told me you guys all did a little bit of Fortran, right? Mm-hmm. So the sort of tilde equal tilde syntax was inspired by the way you do like relational operators in Fortran. So hopefully it'll be kind of familiar to you. You can define one lepton by selecting from WZT the events that pass that criterion, that the number of things of light leptons is equal to one. It's probably going to take a little bit of guesswork and asking me questions to figure out how to modify the syntax. Well, there's this function reference list. I mean, we actually explain what these things are, and this thing is sort of structured as a tutorial. So it's somewhat documented. I'm not sure if it'll be enough, but you should ask me if you have questions. Close that. Okay, so we were on the event selections. So you defined one lepton. You can go through and run two lepton. B tag, and those are going to select different subsamples. So we can quickly cross-check these number of lepton things against the dominant sources from the log file, what we would have expected. So according to the log file, we had about 37,000 W's. That's our main source of one lepton events. Now, about 20% of those W's go to leptons. So we would expect to have a fifth of that, or about, 6K one lepton events. And I think that's roughly consistent with what we've got, right? Yeah, pretty close. There's also some inefficiency thrown in there, so that's why it's a little less than 6K. You would have expected 7K. And then I included the efficiency to get 6. Likewise, for events with two leptons, those are mostly coming from Zs. So we had 12,000 Zs. And then the probability of getting two leptons out of a Z. It's basically 3% for flavor, so 6%. So we would have expected like 720, right? Did I do the math right? Yeah, 720 Z's. And again, there's some efficiency, so you only get a fraction of that. And then B tags, okay. Well, we know the dominant source of B tags is top. Well, no, it's not, because the number of B tags in this is 1,000. We had, and we only had 40 tops. So there's a couple of things that those events could be coming from. Some of them are probably coming from Z's. The Z to BB bar fraction is something I'm going to have to cheat on. Very well measured at LEP, by the way. So out of those 12,000 Z's, we take 15%, and that should give us something in the neighborhood of 1,800 events with B bar. And then about, if the B tag percentage is about 75%, then, I mean, sorry, it's about 50%, but we have two Bs in the event. So that means that there's a 50% chance of one B, of tagging one B, and a 25% chance of tagging both Bs. So you'd expect about 75% of those, which is around the number that you get in the sample, to have at least one B tag. So those are subsamples that we expect this one to be dominated by Ws, this one to be dominated by Zs, the B tags to also be dominated by Zs. And then this one hard lepton you don't really need to run, but it implements a more realistic lepton selection. So because they need to have low trigger rates, the LHC experiments usually have lepton thresholds around 10 to 20 GeV. And this is selecting the ones with 10 PT. Actually, sorry. This is selecting the number of leptons with PT greater than, selecting events with exactly one lepton PT above 15, not 20 as the comment says. Okay, so those are the sublists we set up. Now, sorry, let's get on to the fun stuff. So this run inclusive counts takes quite a while to run. You can run it, but I recommend that you copy the command someplace else so that while it runs we can talk about it. So this is just counting the number of events with different numbers of photons. So most of the events don't have photons. A lot of these are probably fakes. Number of events with different numbers of jets. There's lots of jets in the events. The number of B jets, that's what we already saw. Leptons, so again, we already saw this, selected this list, that one, so not so much. Now, here's another interesting thing to do is to break down opposite sign and same sign dileptons. So like opposite sign is an E plus E minus or an E plus mu minus. Same sign is like E plus E plus. So where might we get same sign leptons from in this sample?
Two Ws.
Right, but we didn't generate two Ws. So in the real world, we get it from two Ws of the same sign. But in this sample, we didn't generate two Ws. The only thing we generated with two Ws is TT bar, where they're always opposite sign.
TT bar.
But they're always opposite sign. So yeah, we've got TT bar, Z plus jets, W plus jets. So the answer is that all of those actually have to be fakes, somehow faked. So either you have a W plus jet event with one lepton, and the jet produces something that gets mistagged as a lepton. That's one possibility. Or you have a Z event where you misidentify the sign of one of the leptons, so it gets called the same sign. Or you have a B decay, B meson decay, for example, in TT bar, that really does produce a lepton. Usually the purpose of these isolation requirements, like that upon muon isolation that we imposed, is to try to discriminate muons that really came from the decay of a meson inside of a jet from the sort of real muons from the high PT physics, which are what we're interested in. But sometimes they get it wrong and you count the muons from a meson decay instead. So you shouldn't take the fake rate implied by this number too seriously. That's one of the things that this PGS gets sort of very qualitatively right, but the numbers don't reflect the reality of either experiment. We can break this down. So now again, you have single and dilepton counts. So this is the number of events with exactly one lepton that's either an electron, muon, tau of either sign. Now you see there's more E plus than E minus. I should tell you, by the way, this was actually simulated for a 14 TeV LHC, not a 7 TeV LHC, because that's what everybody talked about 3 years ago, before we knew what kind of energy the LHC could actually achieve. So why is the E plus rate higher than the E minus rate? Yeah, it's proton-proton collisions, exactly. So most of these single leptons, we already discussed what process they're coming from, right? It's W's. So if you think about what processes produce a single W, if we do it a little more carefully, actually writing down the species of the quarks, we've got UD bar goes to W plus, and D U bar goes to W minus. Now, these guys are always coming from this C parton distribution, right? There's no intrinsic down content at high momenta in the proton. Sorry, D bar. These guys get a contribution from the valence quarks. And at the valence level, at the very high momenta of the parton distribution functions, so this is roughly what the PDFs look like for this is a function of x on some log scale from like 10 to the minus 4 to 1. And this is extremely cartoonish. This is x times f of x. So this common behavior at low x is all C. These here are, say, an up quark, down quark, and these are the all of the Q bars for a proton. So the point is, at the highest energies, you're sensitive to the fact that a proton has two up quarks and one down quark. And so you're more likely to produce a W plus from an up quark and a C anti-quark than a W minus from a down quark and a U bar from the C. So this is really coming from the high energy valence PDFs, that difference. And that means, what I just told you means that it's going to be somewhat kinematics dependent, right? That there should be regions of the phase space where you produce W's that are very sensitive to the valence, regions that are not so sensitive to the valence. And in some regions, you'll see a big asymmetry, and in other regions, you won't. Now, for Zs, we've got a similar table. Oh, and the difference between E's and mu's, say, like the fact that mu has a lower number than E's, that's just the efficiency as implemented in PGS. And it's not necessarily reflective of the truth. So for example, in CMS, the muon efficiency is actually about 10% higher than the electron efficiency. In Atlas right now, I think the electrons are performing better than the muons. But some of that's gonna evolve with time. So now again, we have the same kind of distributions for for E plus E minus, mu plus B minus. Oh, and also notice that the tau numbers are huge. The tau numbers are huge because jets fake taus all the time. So most of the, and again, that is like at order one, completely mismodeled by PGS. But qualitatively, this fact is true. Jets fake taus all the time. If you look at a sample of tau-tagged events, most of them never thought of having a tau in them. They're just jets. And the reason is that the hadronic tau decay just looks like a couple of particles. They're basically looking for a very, very narrow pencil-like jet. But sometimes QCD gives you pencil-like jets, too. That's just, and there's a lot more jets than taus in the world. So that's why those are so high. Now, in the dileptons, so let's just forget about taus. So we don't have any same sign here. So the only same signs we have, turns out, are same sign with taus, right? So that makes sense. Those are just coming from fake taus. If we look at the E's and mu's, the E plus E minus and mu plus B minus are a lot higher than the tau plus tau minus. The diagonals in this square are a lot higher than the off diagonals. The reason is that these diagonals get a contribution from the Z. Where might you get an E minus mu plus event from? Right, which you can get just WW production in the standard model, but in this sample, that's just in tops. And in general, these opposite flavor distributions are one place that you can look for in new physics because they're not as abundantly populated as the same flavor. Okay, these are examples of some counting functions that you can play with later. Histogram of the number of jets. Counting with pre-selection. So I want to skip down to histograms. This is just a little documentation of how to make histograms. Okay. So different people, different papers, different experiments use different names and slightly different definitions for things that are called sum PT variables or effective mass variables. They all take the form of taking, so sometimes these are called HT, ST, M-effective. In the new physics analyses use all three of those names. But basically, these are all just sums of the PTs of different objects in the event. Usually either taking a fixed number of objects and summing their PTs together, or taking, say, all jets with PT greater than 30 and summing their PTs. And for this sample of WZ and top events, mostly dominated by the W and the Z, it has this kind of distribution. So these guys with zero, those are just the events where actually nothing triggered. Nothing very interesting was recorded. Probably Z goes to invisible is most of this column. The events that just had a line 6, a missing energy, those end up getting zero in this zero bin. And in any realistic triggered experiment, you would never see those. Right? You need to have some objects in the event to trigger on. But this is just to give an idea of intrinsically what's going on for these TT bar and W and Z processes. Then you've got this lower bulge, which is probably, I'm guessing this is leptonic W's and Z's, since I'm just summing the jets they don't have much energy. That's just from the radiated jet. There's this bulge around 75-ish, which I think is coming from hadronic W and Z decays. And then there's a tail. In practice, you would never see a distribution like this for two reasons. The first is what I said, you have to impose a trigger. And for example, in a hadronic trigger, you would actually put the cut somewhere like here, between 100 and 150. And that cut threshold is going to go up for hadronic triggers is going to go up a lot in this year's data taking because they have higher rates, more higher rates, and they just have to raise it. And because of something called pileup, which is when you have sort of noisy QCD events going on in the background at the same time as your interesting event. And it just increases the overall amount of energy in the event. So you'd never see it for that reason, and you'd never see it because QCD has a rate that dwarfs all of this, and we just haven't simulated the QCD. Because I'm mainly interested in showing the kinematic distributions for events that have leptons. Yeah, so if you zoom in, you can see that this peak actually, that it was peaked sort of around the W and Z masses. But again, this is not a visible distribution. Okay, so here's some histograms that are actually pretty much observable in some approximation. So Z to E plus E minus is fairly clean. I mean, it would be more fun to look at all the experimental papers for these and what they actually observe, how big the backgrounds are. But this is also to give you some idea of how to play around with the reconstruction yourself. So I'll just tell you what this command syntax means. So this whole bin wrapping a bunch of the arguments, that's completely apocryphal. You could remove it, and the command would still work. And that's explained up in the first section on histograms. But in like Mathematica 5, in order to generate nice histograms, I needed to use this convoluted syntax for some reason. So just ignore the fact that some of them are treated as arguments of bin, some of them aren't. The first argument, this WZT, is which data set you're analyzing. And then there's a selector. So this selector, lepton content, 1 minus 1. 1 stands for electron, minus 1 stands for... Probably 1 stands for positron, minus 1 for electron. So that says that's picking out from WZT the events with exactly 1 lepton, 1 electron, 1 positron, and no other leptons in them. And then this HGET is taking the two highest PT leptons. So OL matches a lepton. This is saying pick out from the event. That's what HGET does. Pick out the two highest PT leptons. Since I've already specified that these events have exactly one electron and one positron, you know those are going to be the electron and the positron. And then take the full four-vector invariant mass of those two. And you reconstruct a nice little Z-peak. And you can do the same thing with muons. You get garbage if you do it with taus. And I'm actually not sure if these are hadronic decay products of real Zs. Is your Mathematica having problems? Or? It's quite possibly that my new histogram command that works in Mathematica 8 doesn't actually work in 6 or 7 or whatever you guys have. Okay. Yeah, we can debug the histogram making. If I can debug with one of you offline, that would be helpful. And then, as I was saying, in this idealized world, it's easy to see Z to BB bar. So again, I'm selecting events with two B jets. It's mostly Z to BB bar, picking out the two B jets and taking their invariant mass. So this is idealized. There's no QCD background. With QCD background, it's a doable but hard analysis. So it's been done at the Tevatron. I don't think it's been done at the LHC yet, but it will be. You see that the peak is a lot wider. That's because the energy resolution for jets is a lot worse than for leptons. For a lepton, you just have this one track, and you can use the, at least at moderately low momenta, say below 100 JeV, you can use the deflection of that one track to get a very precise measurement of the momentum. For a jet, since the energy is split among a whole bunch of tracks, you can't do that. You use the calorimeter, and those at these energies, the calorimeter has a much bigger energy resolution. So this, again, qualitatively, this is the correct fact. Depending on the exact way that the jets are reconstructed in the experiment, you'll get a different resolution. But the Z in BB bar always looks a lot broader than in leptons. Like I said, so this is actually a good thing to close on, since we're looking at a lot of Monte Carlo distributions. If there is one thing that you take away from this discussion, it should be that Monte Carlo is tuned to data. It is not a first principles prediction. So you should not trust the results of Monte Carlo quantitatively until they've been validated directly in the data. And that's why when you look at search papers, they'll often try to calculate the background. They'll say, this is a process that we know contributes to the background in this region that we're interested in, we want to look for Susie in this region. We know that, say, top decaying to taus is a background. But instead of using Monte Carlo to calculate the top to taus cross-section, they will relate it to they will look at actual top to mu events and use those events to deduce what the top to tau contribution to their signal region should be. Because the Monte Carlos just are not ab initio predictions. You can tune the parameters in different ways to get totally different answers, and by factors of a few. That's all tuned to data. In particular, Pythia, which has just a parton shower, not the not matrix. So there's, well, something like Pythia just takes 2-to-1 or 2-to-2 events and uses a parton shower Monte Carlo to simulate extra radiation from it. And the parton shower is a good approximation to QCD when you're talking about radiation that's roughly collinear with the jet or that's very soft. When you talk about, but there's also radiation that it does a pretty bad job modeling, where you have a QCD, a gluon emission that's far from the direction of the original parton. And so that's usually handled with higher order matrix element calculations. So there's things like Madgraf, AlpGen are the names of two of the popular Monte Carlos that calculate that. But again, those are also tuned to data, but they do a somewhat better job than Pythia reproducing these high jet multiplicities. Okay, so these are examples of things that we don't trust Pythia for, mostly as syntax examples. W's, the last time I was here, we talked about the shape of W distributions. Qualitatively, here are some actual pictures. So I defined the transverse mass function. And again, in Z events, the transverse mass of the two leptons looks like this. W events, transverse mass with the missing energy looks like this. Okay. Some missing energy distributions. Okay, so this is sort of a, I don't think I'm going to go through the evidence for top, because I don't think we'll be able to do it clearly enough in 5 minutes. So yeah, that's, do you guys have questions other than wanting to get Monte Carlo to work, the Mathematica to work on this stuff?
Actually, I was going to ask about, so we're talking a little bit about tops, and I happened to, a couple weeks ago, to go to the seminar that was about some results that they're finding at the Tevatron with like
foreign
band
for that, yeah.
I was wondering if you might have anything to say about that. I was curious.
Not real. I mean, what do I have to say about it? So, for those of you that didn't go to the seminar, it was the introduction to the seminar was actually really clear, I thought, right? Sort of explanation of where the asymmetry came from.
But you
watched it on Persa. Or sorry. Oh, no, you're saying you didn't.
Seminar,
oh, you're saying you saw that it was listed.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well,
yeah.
Okay, I'm saying that I went to a seminar while I was in New York.
Elsewhere. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Sorry. Sorry.
No.
So last week, the week before last, Matt Strassler gave a particle physics seminar here on the top forward backward asymmetry.
Okay.
Rather than saying anything about it myself, what I'd like to do is encourage you guys. Okay. I'll say two things about it. The Tevatron has measured a forward-backward asymmetry in TT bar. What that means is that the Tevatron has a proton beam and an antiproton beam, unlike the LHC. And they try to measure the ratio of the difference between top events that go like this, where the top goes in the direction that the antiprotons came from, versus so you've got PP bar going to TT bar, where the top goes in the direction that the antiproton came from, minus the reverse processes, where you have the top going towards the proton's incoming direction, T bar going the other way, and then they divide it by the sum of the same two rates. So they can deduce this by looking at events where one of the tops decays to a lepton, to a leptonic W, and then if it was a T, it goes to an L plus. If it was a T bar, it goes to an L minus. And they can look at the direction of that lepton relative to the beam, the orientation of the proton beam. And they see a somewhat significant discrepancy with the standard model predicts that this process should be small. In QCD, it only happens at next to leading order. They see something that's somewhat bigger. And Matt Strassler gave a nice seminar about here that should be on PIRSA about this. He spent most of the time actually explaining to the string theorists in the audience where the asymmetry arises from. And what asymmetry measurements are all about. So I encourage you guys to listen to that if you're curious. It was a very, very good introduction to the subject. But I have nothing particularly enlightening to say about it, so.
Okay.
Yeah. All right, so.
I would lean towards more LHC, but I don't want to go with a lot of points.
I want to do like a little bit of dark matter.
Like, how much dark matter do you guys want to do?
So cold outside. Why is it so cold? I was like, oh, I don't need to wear a coat or anything. I walked out like this and I was like frozen by the time I got here.
Yeah.
I
have all my windows open for.
That's why I
wanted
the three simultaneous
things. I only have one computer. I have to be stressed.